Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, I'm on my second beer. Catherine's on a third. I've just called the name of mine wrong. What's it called, really? What's his real name?
I'm on my second beer, David. Let's not mislead.
You've just opened your third, haven't you, Catherine?
It's in a queue.
It's in a queue. Right, okay. So, I'm drinking San Miguel, apparently. I thought it was called San Miguel, but not to worry. I've had three of them. We've just watched the men's singles final, and it is the sort of final that makes me feel like I've had about five beers, even if I hadn't. Because it was a meandering, delirious... I don't really know how to sum it up. It was just bonkers.
Yeah, I'm slightly worried that the match is just a big blur in my mind and I'm going to struggle to talk about what actually happened. I can remember very strongly the feeling of it happening and how I felt watching it. I think that will be etched into my mind forever because it was one of those matches where by the end I was just so on edge and so tense for both players. But trying to rationalize what happened might be quite a difficult task, I think.
Mm. Is it a bit like last year's final when Rafa Nadal led two sets to love and a break? And that looked over, and then suddenly it was in a fifth set. Is it a bit like that?
No, I don't think so.
It was far lower quality, I would say, throughout. I thought last year's final was really good, like the whole time. This one was patchy, but the idea of it being not that interesting because it's looking like it's going to be a straight sets win. And then suddenly you don't want the match to end and you kind of want it to go on forever. In that sense, it was similar. But I don't think quality-wise or sort of the reasons for why it ended up being such a dramatic match were that similar at all.
I also think that Medvedev's comeback last year was completely unexpected, I think, against somebody like Nadal. Or not somebody like, against Nadal, if you're two sets to love down in your first Grand Slam final, very few people are predicting a way back. I think even at two sets and a breakdown today, most people watching were waiting for Dominic Thiem to wake up and waiting for something that felt like surely it has to happen. Surely at some stage today, even if it's only a small resurgence, you know, a break back, pushing the set to a tie break or winning a set, people were waiting to see the real Dominic Thiem. It felt like only a matter of time and whether he could get it together in time before it was over. But for me, that was quite a crucial difference in how this one felt to how last year felt.
I will remember this match, I think, in the long run for the final set and for the final set tiebreak. But you can't have that without the other stuff that comes before. It's just the way it goes. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the start of the match and how weird it was. It was weird. It was, first of all, Alexander Zverev, totally different man to the guy who came out against Pavlyuchenko in a buster and looked just totally paralyzed with nerves and unable to play his normal game. He looked free out there for those first two sets. He looked languid. He has a languid power unlike anybody else, I think. He sort of generates speed of shot, whether it's the serve of 137 miles an hour or a forehand that's kind of hit the back fence without you realizing he's actually hit it that hard. I don't think anybody else gives me that kind of feeling out on the circuit at the moment. I can feel the power of everybody else. His is almost a sleight of hand the way he does it, but he was just timing the ball way, way better. And also the intent was there and he was coming into the net. I mean, the statistics on his net approach is, I think after a set and a half, he'd gone to the net 20 times and with some success. I mean, he looks uncomfortable at the net, but he was just playing the odds almost, just using his 6 foot 6 inches, his wingspan, great ground strokes, get into the net. And Dominic Thiem was absolutely awful. What was going on with Dominic Thiem in those first two sets? I mean, he was appallingly bad, wasn't he? I thought he was injured.
Well, he's just been in his press conference and said that it was all nerves. He was so, so tight throughout the whole day, and it just affected him when he got on the court in those first two sets, and he couldn't generate the kind of power that he usually gets on his strokes because he was so tight. And that was the striking thing for me. He was lacking his usual explosion into the ball and his dynamic, aggressive movement. It was a dismal first two sets, and I've not seen him play like that in years. So it was clear that something had to be going on. I agree. I thought maybe that there was the continued problem of the Achilles, but he's put it down to nerves, and it was really curious because I was, before the match, in my head kind of visualizing what I thought the rallies might look like, and it was not like that at all. I thought they would have long extended rallies and Thiem would push Zverev off the court. It wasn't the case at all, and Zverev did an incredible job of shortening the points and, as you said, coming to the net, his touch and his half volleys were a revelation, to be honest. Not always, as you said, done looking particularly convincing, but they got the job done. And he looked totally in command, Alexander Zverev. Even his serve, he'd figured out how to cover up the problems he was having by serving and volleying on it. And it kind of gave him that forward momentum on his second serves. And it wasn't too bad to begin with. But it was definitely the case that Thiem was flat and lackluster, and he has put that down to just feeling completely overwhelmed and racked with nerves.
I love that honesty, and it does make perfect sense now that I know that. I wish we knew that at the time, really, because it just felt so curious at the time.
Yeah, especially with the Achilles injury mystery thrown into the mix, different mix to the usual mix. A bit of a red herring. I mean, maybe it was something that the fact that maybe that was playing on his mind, if not an actual injury, just that fear of, I had a bit of a thing in my last match. What if it flares again? You know, that overthinking thing. Have either of you ever felt tight, the kind of tight that tennis players feel in big matches? Do either of you feel like you've ever experienced that? I mean, obviously we've all felt nerves. I feel nerves all the time, but that, I don't think that's the same. Then, you know, it's not, I mean, maybe they have jittery tummy and pounding heart and sweaty palms and all the rest of it as well, but, you know, the way tennis players describe having heavy legs and, you know, an arm that weighs a ton and all the rest of it. Do
I
you
would
feel like
yes.
You've ever felt that?
Yeah, I have.
To tell me what it feels like.
I think the only thing I could say is
When did it happen?
Well, it's happened a number of times. But I think the only way that I could give you a sample of how it might affect people like us is if you went into a live TV studio and suddenly felt like you weren't going to be able to do it, you know, when you went live on air. And, you know, I've definitely felt that.
Yeah,
before.
I can imagine it, but I have never felt that the way tennis players describe it. I have felt tremendous nerves and anxiety on an almost daily basis in my life. But I can't, I wish I could just for a split second, not for too long because it sounds awful, but I wish I could just feel it for a second so I could understand what it's like.
I would say your experience is the opposite because you're almost like a number of the players who, when they get on the big stage, that's them at their best. That's when they feel they're most comfortable. In your case, when the light goes on, you actually start broadcasting.
I've somehow made this about me.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because it is something that it's just a very human reaction to something that you desperately, desperately want to go well. And it means that much to you. And look, I think a lot of people who've maybe done exams or they've gone to a job interview or they've just had a massive moment in their lives have had this. I've definitely had it. But
do you understand what I mean? Meaning by sort of the I'm talking about the manifestation of it. I'm not talking about the feeling of intense nerves and caring.
No, but I'm saying that I think the tangible effects of actually I can't do what I normally can do. I just can't do it because I'm too tight. It just isn't happening. I wish I could kind of like to watch the match again now that I know what he said because it all totally makes sense.
I rewatched a little bit just now. I was interrupted by, you know, a Zoom call from you two.
Wonder why you look so annoyed.
Which part did you rewatch?
So I watched sort of the very opening exchanges, and then I fast forwarded to 3-4 in the fifth.
Oh, okay. Because yeah, I just fast forwarded to 3-4.
Right. I wanted to see Dominic Thiem sort of trying to settle. I wanted to sort of see his face again and yeah, exactly, with the benefit of hindsight and what he said. And he was clearly extremely nervous.
So how did he work his way back into it then? He's two sets to love down. How did it turn around that he ended up in a fifth set?
Well, I mean, Zverev had a break in the third set and played a poor game to get broken back. And I think Zverev, once he got into the lead, once the finish was in sight, to me, he tightened and he started retreating further, further and further behind the baseline. And Thiem was suddenly in a position where, hang on a minute, I need to get a move on in this match. And he started playing a whole lot better. And the rallies got much longer and they started resembling the sort of rallies that he wanted to be having. And then it felt quite natural that Thiem would go on from there and win, as you said. I mean, as we said yesterday, once the match turned to one that Thiem was comfortable with, he's the better player. And he won those third and fourth sets without too much fuss. And that was the match I was expecting. Thiem sort of dominating from the back of the court and Zverev not really quite being able to live with him, having problems with his serve. And it suddenly felt familiar. And I was like, oh, okay, this match suddenly makes sense to me after a first two sets which were perplexing because Thiem was so nervous and couldn't find the court and Zverev was really impressive. The third and fourth sets were much more what I was expecting, and then all hell broke loose in the fifth set, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly you adjust on a micro scale within a match. You adjust your expectations. And I felt exactly the same. Kind of as soon as Thiem broke back in the third set, I was like, oh, well, this is going to five then. Like, this is, you know, normal service resumed. It's what's come up to now has been an aberration. Not necessarily, I don't mean in terms of Zverev playing really, really well. Just in terms of what you were saying, Matt, about the pattern of the match, the pace of the match. It was just right. Okay, so now we're into the match. Then it's going to go to a fifth set. Let's get there and see what happens. And it happened.
The fifth set was made everything else worthwhile. Everything, because I think around after four sets, the general gist of what I was getting on social media and through other broadcasters and through our conversations on WhatsApp with your brother, Catherine, was that this is not great and not into this particularly. Let's get to the good bit of finding out who wins. I don't know whether you feel that, but that's how I felt. I wasn't massively into it. There were some moments that I enjoyed, but I wasn't massively into it. But the fifth set will have me remembering this match with great affection, enormous affection, because of what it meant to them both and what they showed, how much they showed that it meant to them and how it affected them, how it manifested itself with them barely being able to put tennis balls in the court. I mean, they had some rallies at the end there that I'm thinking, I could win this rally against these two. Okay, maybe that's an exaggeration. But, you know, I felt so sorry for them that they were struggling that much, but it was an excruciating but beautiful thing seeing how much a tennis match meant to them both. And watching them try to sort of wrestle with that.
The most relatable set of tennis in a Grand Slam final of all time, do you think?
Probably,
well, if you think that, I mean, it's not very often you get, and it's certainly not very often in men's tennis in the last goodness knows how many years, that you get two players in this position. Dominic Thiem is in his fourth Grand Slam final. He's been there and done it. Why is he getting nervous? Well, he's not facing Rafael Nadal at the French Open, and he's not facing Novak Djokovic at the Australian Open. He's facing Alexander Zverev. He's supposed to beat him, and he's so nervous. The racket doesn't feel like the racket normally does in his hand. Simple as that. For the whole day.
And the 68-mile-an-hour serve was incredibly relatable. I mean, match point down, Zverev's second serve crept over the net at 68 miles an hour. It was one of my favorite tennis moments ever, just slightly averting my eyes to look at the shot clock while the rally was ongoing. I needed to know how slow that serve was, and I was not expecting it. Even though it was so slow, I just thought, oh, it'll be somewhere in the 70s.
When did
68
that come?
That came
you fast forwarded to the tiebreak.
Yeah, sorry, I have. I was just on the topic of relatability. That was
understood. But I mean, there was a relatable bit at 5-4 because finally, after duking it out, Zverev breaks, or was it 5-3? Zverev breaks and serves for the title,
which felt like a cruel experiment. I thought trying to let's see if Zverev can serve for a Grand Slam title and
in an empty stadium, during a pandemic,
and the answer was quite emphatic.
Poor guy. Yeah, has there ever been more certainty that somebody won't hold serve ever?
I mean, it really didn't feel like he was going to hold serve. No,
just zero chance.
Just no chance.
Though I mean, obviously there was no atmosphere in the stadium but, you know, even the tone of the commentators usually after a match like that, come back from two sets love down, you know, you get a break in the fifth set and someone's left serving for it. There'd be this real dramatic, climactic feel to the commentary. And they knew that wasn't the climax. So they held something back. And maybe that's unfair to Alex Zverev, but I mean, as it turned out, it very much wasn't unfair to Alexander Zverev. I mean, it was so human And so, and in the end, extremely endearing, but it was excruciating as well.
It's not meant as criticism. Who are we to criticize them in that way? And
for me, it's a compliment. I love seeing people that want it so much and care so much that the caring is ruining it. I love that, and I consider it a compliment. I mean, not a compliment to the Zverev second serve necessarily.
Team then gets himself 6-5 up and serves for the title and loses his serve. And into the tiebreak we go. And what was it? This was the 50th anniversary of the tiebreak at the US Open, and the first time the tiebreak has ever been used to decide the men's singles championships. And that's right, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just extraordinary how that happened. And I think this whole period in the match revealed that tennis doesn't necessarily have to be the highest quality to be enthralling. Basically, just entertain me. That's what I want when I watch a tennis match. And this was so incredibly compelling, kind of because they were both struggling and caring so much and wanting it so much. It kind of reminded me of a deciding frame in snooker, where normally they pop the ball so easily in snooker, it isn't always completely compelling to watch. It's sort of so impressive that they're so good at it. But actually the really exciting frames are where they're missing and showing how hard it actually is to pop the balls. And in the tennis case, how hard it is to serve for your first Grand Slam title. That to me is thrilling, and I will watch that over and over again, and that's what I want. It's great if they're both playing well at the same time and you get brilliant tennis in important moments, but it's equally good really if they're both struggling a little bit and it's dramatic. It's theatre.
I've just put it back on. Not that I'm not enjoying seeing both your faces, but I thought I'll just pop it on in the background. Unfortunately, I've timed it badly because I'm watching Team get a very intimate thigh rub and an extremely close-up shot on that.
And there was a moment which we haven't discussed in terms of when the quality was incredible, which was at Team serving at 4-5, 30-all. Team hit back-to-back incredible forehands down the line for winners, one of them falling backwards at 98 miles an hour onto the line, and
30 miles per hour faster than Zverev's serve on match point.
And in the end, I just thought,
no, not match point.
Yeah,
what was
on the match point in the tie break.
Match point.
In the end, I thought, yes, this match was crazy, yes, it was difficult to understand, but in that moment it did actually reveal something about them as players, and that Team was the braver one and the bolder one. And when it was really tight, and when he was down, he still went for it. And Zverev held back a tad, and that is something he struggles with. And in the tightest moments, it came out, I thought. Their characters were revealed.
And when we got into that tiebreak, Team starts cramping pretty horrifically at the start of that tiebreak, and there were points where he's rolling his arm over and he's not bending his knee. You know, he usually does a really pretty exaggerated knee bend into a serve and he throws his whole torso into it. He didn't do that in the tiebreak. He just sort of rolled his arm over because he couldn't, and he still didn't he still hit his fastest serve of the entire match whilst doing that
at 3-all in the tiebreak. 132 mile per hour serve, which for Team is huge. That I think it might be equal fastest for the tournament, and he did it without bending his knees. I do not know from whence that came.
No,
but and just to pick up on what Matt was saying about the character being revealed and what you've described there, how contrasting is that to their off-court personas, where Zverev is the... I'm tired. Give me a word for ballsy that isn't gendered someone. Ah, this is
gutsy.
The problem with the patriarchy. No, I don't mean gutsy.
Cocky?
Yeah. Zverev's the cocky one, and team is the...
gendered?
Yes. Also, oh, crikey. Oh, the world is so disappointing. Give me something else.
Confident? Arrogant?
Plucky?
No.
Well, no, it's not right. There is no non-gendered word for what I'm wanting to describe. Goodness me, we've unearthed an issue.
Especially not after
for another day. Okay, let's go with cocky and agree to discuss alternatives at a later date. Yeah, he's the god. It's not even that interesting a point. yeah, away from the court, it's Zverev the one that's far more out there in terms of what he's prepared to say and how much of himself he's sort of prepared to reveal. And team is the completely reserved one, isn't he? He's extremely sort of earnest and kind of safe in what he says.
Unless you kick him out of an interview room.
Yes.
What the hell?
Yes. Another character revealing moment. What the hell? It's a joke. Oh no, that was a bit Scottish.
Same thing. Yeah, but it wasn't over then, because team gets to 6-4 up in the tiebreak, and he has two match points, and it's over. You think it's over, and then he loses those two points. I mean, I can't exactly remember the points, but I just know he lost them.
He missed a forehand into the net on one of them, and a forehand wide on one of them. The second one being the point that started with the 68 mile an hour serve. And he was so far back, he sliced the return. It was a 68 mile an hour serve and he sliced it.
Even I'd attack that.
I was desperate for him. Do you remember when, I mean, it feels like a lifetime ago, when Andy Murray played Zverev at the Western and Southern Open and he was just trolling his serve and trying to coax double faults out of him. It was rude.
I've got to say, team's positioning for the serve was just absurd, ridiculous. I mean, I know he likes to load up on the ball and he can be aggressive from back there, but he wasn't being aggressive from back there. It seemed like he was just had no confidence and comfort that he was going to be able to get a proper good read on the ball. So he was just trying to get it back in.
And maybe he was wary of Zverev going for two first serves, just going for bombs on both. I mean, I'm sort of playing devil's advocate. I agree with you, David. But I mean, has there ever been a bigger case of feast or famine on serve? Because he was just on second serve. I mean, obviously the disparity between the first serve and the second serve. But on second serve, he was kind of either going for a nerve-jangling 75 mile per hour at best, or a first serve, which could be 140.
My favourite was when he played a 105 mile an hour first serve that missed, and then a 136 mile an hour second serve that almost killed team.
That's the thing, because he was so reluctant on the second serve, reluctant to even get himself in a situation where he had to hit the second serve. He was taking pace off the first serve to get it in. It was layers upon layers of serving psychology going on.
When they changed ends at 6-6, I was starting to think, I'm not sure this match can actually end in a conventional manner. They might need to like stop the fight or something, you know, like a referee coming and just declaring a winner or something, because they just looked as though they couldn't handle it at all. Either one of them. Oh, I felt so sorry for them when they were the horrors they were going through.
I've just rewatched Zverev double faulting at 2-1 up with a mini break in the tie break. It is so painful.
There's another double fault in a minute. He hit two in the tie break, I think. And the other thing about the tie break that was jarring and scarring was seeing team physically unable to last. I was so surprised by that, because if there's one thing that I will always back team to be, it is physically strong. Okay, I did think it slightly let him down in Australia a little bit in that fifth set against Djokovic as well. He does expend so much energy into every shot that maybe I need to rethink, and maybe team does get a little bit fatigued in fifth sets. But this wasn't a particularly grueling five setter in terms of the rallies. They weren't really lengthy. So it was kind of shocking to see. And then he's just come into his press conference and said that was all nerve related as well. He thinks he was cramping because he was nervous, and that there's that connection, isn't there, between the psychological and the physical. And he was feeling that. And he said he hadn't cramped for years. And it was the occasion and the nerves that forced him to cramp. And that is again such honesty, but also just an illustration of what they were feeling out there. And kind of, as you said, Catherine, yes, it was a relatable final, but I find that really difficult to relate to in terms of nerves physically incapacitating you. I don't think I have experienced that.
Mm. I think I have, but just watching it, that element of it made the final. Those nerves and what it meant to them to get over the line, one or the other, and the other one not to, that's what will be taken from this final, because there wasn't enough good tennis for it to be memorable on its own for that. And there was good tennis. I don't want to diss the final in that regard completely, but it became memorable. It finished 8-6 in the fifth set tiebreak for team sitting on his chair afterwards in hysterics at the absurdity of it all, and how edgy he was that he ended up just collapsing into laughter. And poor old Zverev's face. I mean, I find him a hard guy to like sometimes, or to pull for. He's not the one I instantly pull for. He just isn't. And that may be due to me not being that into his game. It may be because he's so chippy sometimes and arrogant. But I've never doubted how much he loves it, how much he desperately, desperately wants to be the best, and how he wants to achieve, how hard he's trying to achieve. And he is, we've talked about this before, he is one of the very best post-match interviews on court.
Yeah.
Or post-match speakers. He has a lovely way about just taking the microphone, and I mean, he can ramble a bit, he can go on forever, but I mean, he connects with you because you just feel like at that point he just lays it all bare. He's not trying to defend, he's not trying to protect, he's just telling you how he feels. And when he did take the microphone and he talked about his parents and that they tested positive for the coronavirus and they weren't there, and you could just feel everything that they'd gone through as a family together at that point. And actually what a good guy Alexander Zverev is, really, when you strip away the arrogance and when you strip away the sort of privilege that has probably been built up over how many ever years he's been told he's going to be this, that or the other, and the opportunities he's been given. Strip all that back and he's actually just a competitor who wants to show he's got it. He's desperate to. And it was heartbreaking to him that he couldn't get over the line and he couldn't do it and he blew it. I really I think we all felt for him at that point. I think everybody watching him felt for him.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, I was crying in the Prime Video studio. Daniela and I were... I mean, Daniela cries in every trophy presentation ceremony I've ever seen her witness. It just gets to her. But I was crying as well. It was definitely his, you know, I'm getting closer moment for me anyway. You know, I love it when they show the humanity and lay it all bare. And, you know, I also love it when they, well, it gets to me when they have their parents watching, but it turns out even worse is when their parents should have been watching and were prevented from being there. That really got to me. But is that what you think, David? Did he blow it? That's the big question, isn't it? Did he blow it?
Well, yeah, he did. He was serving for the match, and he didn't have that wrenched from his grasp on just team shots. He tightened up.
And how?
He's 6 foot six. He's got a 137 mile an hour serve. I mean, he tried his best. He just couldn't handle the moment. He just couldn't serve out when it mattered.
So how does he stop this now scarring him deeply? I mean, really deeply. Next time, if he gets himself in that position again, serving for the match of his life, how does this not affect him?
Well, it might, and it certainly wouldn't be surprising if it did. And I do fear for him a little bit in that regard, in as much as it's your first one, and it's not the big three for a start. He may have to go through a year or two still. I mean, what happens when he plays Djokovic in his next final, for instance, and Djokovic isn't nervous? Maybe. I think the assumption is that, oh, he'll have, as they always say, and Dominic Thiem was at pains to say, you'll have loads more opportunities. And actually, they're very close, of course, those two. Maybe he won't, for a start. There are other good players. But I think from a Zverev perspective, and looking at other people who have lost several finals and gone on to, and bear in mind he's only lost one, but lost several and gone on to then win. Murray did it. Ivan Lendl did it. Well, you keep putting yourself in the position, don't you? And I actually really like the fact that Zverev, who's got the yips on his serve at times and has got this real Achilles heel with it, doesn't shy away. Still keeps putting himself out there. Still keeps being prepared. He's prepared to fail. Time after time, he's prepared to fail. And I respect him for that.
And I think the way I look at it is that if he'd won this slam, it would have been the kind of tennis equivalent of a football smash and grab. It was kind of like pinching a 1-0 win away at Man City. He'd... all tournament, he'd been sitting deep, playing defensively. But then when it really mattered in the final to begin with, he was outstanding. And it was almost like he just sort of grabbed it right at the end, but he didn't quite. But I actually think, as much as there's been talk of Zverev as a potential Grand Slam champion for a long time, game-wise, I don't think he's particularly ready to be a Grand Slam champion when you consider the holes and the frailties that he has in his game, particularly the serve. But I mean, his forehand was great today, but also his forehand can break down. And, you know, he did very well to get to the final of this tournament, but he had a laborious route there, and he didn't have to face, I don't think, anyone ranked inside the top 25 to get to the final. So the way I look at it is that the next time he gets to a Grand Slam final, I'd have thought he might have smoothed out some of those rough edges in his game, and he might be a better player by the time he gets there. I think the key for him is to improve his game and take that to a Grand Slam final rather than try and deal with another Grand Slam final with this game, if that makes sense. Because I think there are still so many ways he can improve, and that's a positive thing. Because he's already an established top 10 player who's won big titles. But if he can improve his game and overcome this, mainly this problem of the second serve, the next time he's in a Grand Slam final, he might not be having these issues, and he'll be in a better place, therefore, to deal with the nerves.
I completely agree with you, Matt. But there is, I do think there's a little irony in there, in that had he just managed to nick this one today, I think that in itself would have solved a lot of the problems, because so many of the problems are psychological. The when things got tight today, when Dominic Thiem started surging back at him, he reverted to his cautious default of being a 6 foot six inch counter puncher, and suddenly his forehand that had looked world beating for two sets, I mean, it was rifling through the court in a way that I've never seen before. Suddenly the forehand was back to dropping short and sitting up, and if he did try and go for it, as you said, it broke down, and you know, you could see the double faults coming. And I think so much of that is psychological, that just being a Grand Slam champion and having got over that hurdle, however he had done it, would have made, it's kind of putting the cart before the horse, isn't it? That would have accelerated his game to the stage where he was perhaps a more, not worthy, I'm not doing very well with words tonight, worthy isn't quite right, but a more ready Grand Slam champion. But that would have been a shortcut, I suppose. That would have been a bit of a cheat code. He'll have to do it the slightly harder way. And I hope this doesn't scar him in the way that it could. I'm a little bit fearful. It could go either way. I mean, the level of devastation, obviously, that will spur him on. There is no doubting his desire. No one has ever doubted his work rate and his commitment. If anything, that's possibly been to his detriment at moments in the past. You know, he's possibly worked too hard, trained too hard, thought that he could practice and train his way through problems when that's not always the case. But he was so broken today. And, you know, only four times in the Open era has a man lost a Grand Slam final from two sets to love up. All four of those occasions occurred at the French Open. It has never happened outside of the French Open. Manuel Lorantes, John McEnroe against Ivan Lendl in 1984.
And we know how much that hurt
scarred McEnroe.
Yeah.
Andre Medvedev against Andre Agassi, and Gaston Gaudio against Guillermo Coria. And okay, Manuel Orantes went on to win the US Open the following year. So he did win a slam after that happened. John McEnroe went on to win Wimbledon after that French Open, but that was it for his slams, wasn't it? And I take him slightly apart from it all because he was already a multiple Grand Slam champion at that stage. But, you know, Gaston Gaudio didn't, Andre Medvedev didn't. I don't know.
You mean Guillermo Coria?
Sorry,
didn't.
I mean, yeah. Guillermo Coria, yes. I just don't think that is a great list of names for Zverev to find himself with.
Do you think you'll pull for him a bit more mentally in your mind after this? Because I think some of those images will stay with me.
Yeah, definitely. You know what a sucker I am for that kind of stuff. For vulnerability and rawness, and I just want people to be real, even if the reality has some darker sides to it. And yeah, I absolutely, look, I'm sure that can easily be undone with a chippy, irritating press conference comment, but absolutely, elite sport for me is about caring and wanting it, and I really, as much as it was ugly at times, I really relished in how much he wanted it today, and the fact that wanting it so much was his downfall. And I know that's awful for him, but it's kind of a, I don't know, help me out with words.
It's a delicious.
It's kind of tantalising.
And poor bloke.
and the sliding doors. What this could do for team, and what this could have done for team if he hadn't won this. I mean, he has mentioned himself that record that he had in slams a number of times, and he's admitted it was on his mind in this match. And if he'd gone 0-4, I think no matter how he'd lost this final, if he'd lost it in straight sets and been terrible, that would have been difficult to get over. If he'd lost it in five sets, having had the comeback and still not managed to win, that would have been terrible to get over. But the fact that he's won it now could change him as a force and as a player as well. So it's I think the margins are so thin.
More dangerous now. I think he could. It could be a real launch pad for him.
It's been a long time since anyone's doubted his game, since anyone's questioned whether he has the game to be a Grand Slam champion. That hasn't been in doubt for a couple of years now, at least. Since he won Indian Wells, I think.
He imposed that game all the way through this tournament until that final today. And I just feel that there will come a point where he imposes that game against no matter who he's against.
That's what I mean. And that's about mentality, isn't it? It's about belief and mentality and conviction. And what could be more of a boost to all of those things than becoming a Grand Slam champion? It's a total validation of what you're doing. So I completely agree. He's more dangerous now.
And I guess the next step for team is to win a slam going through one of the big three. I mean, not that the fact that he hasn't done that diminishes what he's done, but I imagine there would be a sort of extra level of satisfaction for him if he could personally usurp them and have that kind of poetic changing of the guard moment. I'm knocking you off your court. I am now the man.
Imagine if he takes Nadal out in the final in Roland Garros.
Nadal hasn't played a match yet.
Yeah, but it's Nadal at Roland Garros.
Staying in a travelodge or something.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. A couple of other results to bring you today. The quad singles final was won by the Dutch player, Sam Schroeder, who defeated Dylan Alcott. And the Wheelchair men's singles final was won by Shingo Kaneda of Japan, beating Alfie Hewitt in the final.
That was his 25th Grand Slam title.
Was it? Blimey neck. Wow. I got to, that's incredible.
Whereas it was Schroeder's first Grand Slam main draw.
As a World Cup. Mm. Yep.
That's so cool. Yeah, some good results there as well. 7-6 in the third, Kaneda beat Alfie Hewitt. 2 hours and 54 minutes. I got to speak to Jordan Wiley, the British wheelchair player who in the doubles was victorious today over Yui, along with Yui Kamiji, her long-term doubles partner. And Jordan's great. They won 6-3, 6-3. And she was telling me about how great it was to be watched by her 2.5-year-old son, who was on the video wall when she won. And she'd won the title before he was born, I think a few years ago, and now here she's won it for the first time since he was born. And she's so inspirational. I mean, all of these players are, but she's really cool.
She was supposed to get married this November, but due to COVID restrictions has postponed it to next November. And Yui Kamiji is the bridesmaid at her wedding, which is a lovely, lovely thing. The way they talk about one another is so heartwarming. It's just the absolute loveliest thing.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's really great.
Yeah. So, folks, the US Open has come to an end. This weird and sometimes wonderful US Open has come to an end. I mean, first of all, I think overall, whilst it wasn't perfect, but the USTA did a pretty good job.
Yeah, I think I'd call it wonderful and sometimes weird. I will never, ever forget it.
No. Let's hope we don't have one quite like this again.
Yeah, I really loved it, but please, God, don't let it happen again.
Hmm.
Well, how about in approximately 2 weeks?
Well, they intend to have 10,000 fans in a day whilst they're getting 10,000 blooming coronavirus infections a day in the country.
That worries me more. You know, I actually think having one like this again feels more appropriate. But, you know, we'll see how the French Open goes. But I am concerned about it. But and I think, you know, the USTA, from everything I understand, it was incredibly close that this event would not happen at all. And I'm sure there was so much work behind the scenes that has gone on to get this event on and to run it safely. And yes, it hasn't always been perfect along the way, but I think for their kind of bold risk taking, but with safety in mind, it's been a triumph, really, that it's happened at all.
Yeah, I would second that. It's I hope that all USTA employees are more than three beers down right now. Can you imagine the size of relief?
Yeah.
Yeah. Bottoms up, USTA.
Naomi Osaka has been tweeting a little bit. My word, when she tweets, does she get a reaction? It's incredible. I was looking. She's got about 700,000 followers on Twitter. I know Twitter's, you know, it's only one outlet, and it can't be the barometer of everybody's popularity. But there are people.
Didn't she follow you for about 20 minutes, David?
No, for about 20 seconds. It was clearly an accident. The other big stars in tennis who've got more than 10 million followers, like Serena Williams and Roger Federer and Maria Sharapova, they don't get anything like the engagement that she does for a single tweet. I don't quite know how that works. She's only got 700,000, but she did a tweet yesterday which said, "This is crazy," and a picture of herself with the trophy. 325,000 likes of that tweet, and the other players I've just mentioned, they just get a fraction of that. I mean, I don't know whether something's going on that's a bit weird with Twitter, but I mean, I just feel like she is going to be so big in the future.
Or now?
Yeah, but
maybe,
bigger.
Maybe now is the future?
She's going to be bigger. Now you're getting me confused. It's tomorrow, it's today. It's 5 a.m. I'm getting very confused. But anyway.
She talked about, she did her Champions photo shoot today, didn't she, wearing a Kobe Bryant LA Lakers jersey. And she talked about his influence on her, and the inspiration he gave her this fortnight. And she told this lovely little story, not even really a story, just a one-liner really, about a conversation she once had with him where she said, how did she put it? I'd love to be as good as you one day. And he said, no, be better. That is just so great. So great.
Yeah. I dare say she is going to do a lot more in her career than we even can imagine. Just on a note I'd like to finish on is just to say, I mean, we're intending to be back in a week's time, I think, really, to review Rome and whatever else has gone on and look ahead to what's coming up. Matt and Catherine have got their head in their hands at the thought of another podcast. that will happen in a week's time. In the meantime, if you haven't already, do look up our Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe podcasts, because they're the most important podcasts we've ever done, or certainly two of them. And they're the ones I think we're the most proud of. I certainly am. They're such important stories to tell. Other people have told them, but we really got a lot of different viewpoints and some wonderful tributes to both of them, along with the storytelling as well. So do take the time if you can to listen to those two podcasts. I'm sure you'll enjoy them.
I tell you what, boy, am I glad we did those podcasts before this US Open, because knowing about those two really enriched the way I was able to cover Naomi Osaka. I didn't specifically mention that much about Althea Gibson or Arthur Ashe or what we learned about them during the making of those podcasts, but I just felt such a bigger appreciation of the wider picture with what Naomi Osaka is doing, and I'm very, very grateful for that.
Well said. Right, Matt, you've checked out the caravan.
Yes.
The caravan's no more.
Yes, I had to do that because the checkout time was 10 a.m. and I have not got up before 10 a.m. in 2 weeks. And I was hoping to have tomorrow just sleeping the whole day. So I decided to come home, and I've been trying not to raise my voice too much or laugh too loudly and wake up my parents. But hopefully they haven't come down or sent me a message or anything. So I think we're in the clear.
Their alarm goes off in a minute, folks. Yes. It's 5:05 a.m. I mean, you know, he says he hasn't woken up at 10 a.m. I mean, one day he didn't even go to bed till after that. So that's Matt's week.
Yes, there's a sorry to give a very niche Bruce Springsteen reference, but there is a story that Bruce Springsteen made the River album entirely being up at night, and I have felt very much like taking inspiration from that, finding some sort of stimulation and trying to get my mind working at night. I don't know. You work differently at night, I think. And I've channeled my inner Bruce these last 2 weeks. That sounds like I'm sounding ridiculous saying that, but I've tried.
We love it. We love it. What have you been channeling, Catherine?
What have I been channeling? Well, I left the IMG studios today feeling really, really like, yeah, you've done a good job. I was really pleased with myself, patting myself on the back, it's all gone great. And then I'd been in the car about 5 minutes and I realised I left a drawer full of my pants in my dressing room. So I'm going to have to call someone and ask them to retrieve my underwear. And suddenly I feel less accomplished at life.
Which I've not asked.
I don't know. I don't know what any of that means, but that's the note I've ended on.
Okay.
And I've now got another suitcase that needs unpacking. I haven't even been anywhere.
Right then. See that in 6 months.
Yeah.
Splendid. Well, I can only say from my perspective, I have had the best time recording these podcasts every night in the middle of the night with you both. It's been absolutely
Likewise.
Lovely. It's been
Likewise.
A joy. And I hope you've all enjoyed them wherever you are. We've had some lovely messages, and it really has been heartwarming to us to know that that some of you out there appreciate the efforts we do go to. We do want to make this podcast as good as we possibly can every time we do it. We deeply care about it, and I hope that comes across. So thanks ever so much for listening, and we'll be back. We'll be back in a week's time with a show about Rome, which is about to take place starting tomorrow, and then we'll be doing daily editions of the tennis podcast from Roland Garros.
5 slams.
Yeah. It's going to be amazing. But first, we're going to go to bed. So what we will do is just say a massive thank you to Zeus, our mascot, who has been an absolutely splendid Grand Slam mascot for the US Open. Thank you, Zeus. Thank you to your human Nicholas. And with that, we'll sign off for the night and go to bed. Good night. See you soon.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.